From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Angela Lansbury will receive a Kennedy Center honor this weekend. On today's Fresh Air, she joins us to talk about some of her great performances on stage and screen, starting with her screen debut at the age of 17 in Gaslight. We'll talk about playing a mother at the center of a conspiracy in The Manchurian Candidate and Elvis's mother in Blue Hawaii. We'll discuss her musicals Gypsy, Mame, and Sweeney Todd and her TV series Murder, She Wrote. Angela Lansbury, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Lawyers for the Bush and Gore campaigns filed their written arguments with the U.S. Supreme Court today in the Florida election dispute. The Bush team asked the high court to overturn the Florida state courts and stop any further recounts, while lawyers for the vice president argued that the issue should be decided by state rather than federal courts. Meanwhile, in Tallahassee, Florida, a state court has finished a hearing on a request by Gore for a hand recount of about 13,000 disputed ballots. Gore wants court officials to count Miami-Dade and Palm Beach County ballots that went through counting machines without showing a choice for president. The Bush team says those voters didn't express a choice and that the counting is unnecessary. The Bush campaign blasted Vice President Al Gore's decision to continue fighting for the Florida vote, saying it's time to give up. NPR's John Burnett reports.
In Austin today, Governor Bush continued moving forward with plans to assemble a presidential administration, despite the fact that after Florida's vote, its recounts, and the certification, his election to the nation's highest office is still not certain. His chief press aide, Karen Hughes, went before reporters this afternoon to respond to Gore's proposal earlier today that Florida conduct another vote count over the next 7 days.
And now, having come up short in all those counts and all those times, Vice President Gore is proposing to make up yet another set of rules. He proposes yet another count and yet another deadline. Common sense does not allow it.
Bush met today with his presumptive chief of staff, Andrew Card, and said he would continue reviewing cabinet appointees all week, though he would not give any names. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
Israel's prime minister said today that he's willing to hold early elections. The minority government is under pressure from opposition parties after 2 months of violent conflicts with Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, in a dramatic announcement, said that he was willing to go to early elections in Israel. That came after the opposition Likud presented a bill to dissolve the Knesset and go to early elections. And once Barak saw that that bill was going to pass at least a first reading, it still would have to go through two more readings, I think he saw the handwriting on the wall and said, okay, you know, if you guys want to go to elections, then I'm willing to, in a very sort of dramatic in combative speech to the Israeli parliament tonight. He said, every election I've ever faced off in, I won. He's convinced he's going to win the elections.
NPR's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 38 points to close at 10,507 in moderate trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 145 points, or 5%, to close at 2,735. This is NPR. Yesterday's election in Canada produced a victory for Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. His Liberal Party won its third parliamentary majority in a row. Chrétien took what some of his advisors thought was a risk by calling early elections, but his party actually increased its number of seats in Parliament. The Liberals gained 41% of the popular vote. The next strongest party was the Conservative Canadian Alliance, which gained 25%. A cold snap has left millions in Ukraine without electricity and wreaked havoc on the national power grid. Several nuclear power reactors were shut down. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Heavy winds and snow blew out power lines, forcing the closure of several reactors in Ukraine. Among them was Chernobyl's reactor number 3. It's the only operating reactor at the Chernobyl power plant, seeing the world's worst nuclear accident. The latest shutdown comes just 3 weeks before Chernobyl is to be taken out of service forever. 50% of Ukraine's electricity is generated from nuclear energy, and officials insist they can't afford to shut down nuclear plants. Western donors are promising to help Ukraine build new reactors once Chernobyl is closed. Despite the latest troubles, officials plan to bring reactor number 3 back online for the next few weeks. The reactor provides Ukraine with 5% of its power. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
American consumers were less optimistic about the economy in November. The Conference Board said its index of consumer confidence fell to its lowest level in more than a year. Lynn Franco, the board's research director, said the drop underscores the public's anxiety about future economic conditions. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This weekend, my guest Angela Lansbury will receive a Kennedy Center honor, along with Chuck Berry, Mikhail Baryshnikov, Clint Eastwood, and Placido Domingo. Lansbury grew up in England and came to the U.S. during World War II. She made her movie debut at the age of 17 in Gaslight and was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance. The following year, she was nominated for another Oscar for her role in The Picture of Dorian Gray. Her other movies include The Harvey Girls, The Long Hot Summer, The Dark at the Top of the Stairs, All Fall Down, and The Manchurian Candidate. On Broadway, she starred in Mame and Sweeney Todd. She starred in the London production of Gypsy. And on TV, she starred in the murder mystery series Murder, She Wrote. Angela Lansbury, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the Kennedy Center honor.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Let's start with your childhood. You grew up in London. Your mother was an actress. What kind of work did she do?
My mother was an Irish actress, and she appeared in a number of various plays during the time that she was working. She started off doing Shaw, George Bernard Shaw, and also Shakespeare, and became also the leading lady of the great English sort of matinee actor, who was Sir Gerald de Maurier. So she played a variety of roles, actually. She was a serious actress. She was not a comedy, musical comedy actress. She was a serious actress.
During World War II, when you were young, your brothers were sent to a family in the countryside, as many British children were, to get away from the bombing. But you wanted to stay home. But your school was moving, so you weren't able to go to school. I think you worked out a deal with your mother that you would be tutored at home and then also take singing and dancing lessons.
That's absolutely true, and I thank goodness I chose to do that, or that she agreed to let me do that. But I think she also was quite happy to have me stay with her, as I was the sort of remaining sibling who was around, and therefore she was quite happy to have me stay at home with her and have classes and start my dramatic training.
So you started drama school during the war, staying home in London. What convinced you then that you liked acting after being so ambivalent about your mother's career?
Well, I realized that what I was going to be doing in the theater really was quite different. Although I didn't realize that at the time, but what I experienced at drama school was the fun and the excitement of being given a part. And when you're a student and you are given a role, something is assigned to you and you're going to do a little scene at the end of the term, that's absolutely the most thrilling thing in the world. So you're doing it, in other words. And my first role was to play Audrey in As You Like It, which is a very comic part. And Touchstone and Audrey have a very funny scene together. And during that scene, I suddenly got the feel and the smell of being able to make an effect by the way I played the role, the way I comported myself. All of the physical aspects of acting suddenly came to me, and I got a laugh, you know, the first time I did it. Well, this was a tremendous kind of boost to my self-esteem, and I went very fast in drama school and ended up working in one of the senior plays even just in my first year. I was assigned a role of a lady-in-waiting in Mary of Scotland. So they obviously knew that this young person had something, she had a talent. And I sort of felt that, although I didn't get big-headed about it, but I felt it, it gave me tremendous confidence.
You came to the United States with your mother. I believe it was during World War II.
Yes, we came in 1940, which was a terrible year because it was the onset of the really big bombing of Britain. Liverpool was bombed right after we left on our ship, which was a Canadian Pacific liner, which was headed for Canada. My mother had been widowed 5 years earlier by the death of my father, and she also was in the middle of a rather unproductive and unsuccessful love affair, and she wanted to get away from it. But mainly, and number one, she recognized the fact that Britain was likely to be bombed and that London really was no place for us to remain if we could possibly get away.
Did you and your mother both want to act in the United States?
Yes. My mother wanted to pick up eventually her career. And when we first arrived, we used to do readings together. We'd do Shakespeare. We'd go to the various schools all around Brearley and New York and Miss Watsit's names. I forget the name. I should remember. and also some of the great prep schools outside of the city. And for $25, which in those days was quite a lot of money, we would do scenes from Romeo and Juliet, and she would do scenes of Desdemona. And she also did epic poems by Alice Stewart Miller and various other writers who were writing epic poems about the war at that time. And she was very, very good at it. She was a great recitalist, as they used to call them in Victorian days, or Edwardian days, I should say. And so I would go along with her in some instances, and many times she went alone. But that was the beginning of her career in the States and mine too.
So sometimes you worked as a team. Did you ever feel competitive with your mother?
I never felt competitive with her, no. I know that eventually, I think it crept in, that green-eyed monster sort of crept in from my mother's side. But
she felt competitive toward you?
Yes, I think so, because she thought, after all, she was a woman. She was only in her 40s, and she was the most beautiful woman, my mother. And she wanted to have a career. She was a very earnest and terribly hard-working actress who found it working and learning roles very, very difficult. Acting for her required tremendous concentration and devotion to duty. And she loved doing it, but it put a tremendous strain on her, whereas I seemed to do it with one hand tied behind my back. So it was there was an unevenness, shall we say, in our approach to the to work.
And you started getting roles in movies.
Well, I eventually, of course, when we moved out to Los Angeles, and I got my first big interview, and I got the part. So my career in movies was jump started by my being accepted for the role of Nancy in Gaslight.
Yeah, let's talk about what led to that audition. You thought you were auditioning for you thought your first role would be in the picture of Dorian Gray. Can you explain how you got a lead for that movie but ended up making Gaslight first?
Yes. Well, I was introduced to the studio, which was MGM, by a young man who was being considered for the role of Dorian Gray. His name was Michael Dine. And he arranged that the casting director would see me, this young English girl who at that time was, I think I was 17. And I went to the studio with my mother and was interviewed for the part of Sybil Vane in Dorian Gray. The head of casting, a man called Billy Grady, came into the room while I was sitting there. He said, sort of whispered in the ear of Mr. Ballerino, the man I was seeing, you should suggest that this young lady meets George Cukor, who's trying to cast the role of the maid in Gaslight. And so right then and there, I was whipped off to meet George Cukor. And the rest is, as they say, is history. I got the part of Nancy and was signed by L.B. Mayer, who saw my test when I was tested for the role. And when L.B. Mayer saw my test, he said, "Sign that girl." And he signed me to a 7-year contract on the basis of the test. Although at that moment, I was not going to get the role. They thought I was just a little bit too young to be able to shall we say, dominate Ingrid Bergman and Charles Boyer. But as it turned out, they changed their minds and let me do it. And then I did National Velvet, and then I finally did Sybil Vane in The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Well, why don't we hear a short scene from your screen debut in Gaslight? And in this movie, Charles Boyer plays a husband who's trying to drive his wife mad. His wife is played by Ingrid Bergman. And this is basically a scheme to institutionalize her so he could take her jewels and her money. You play the maid that he hires. And in this scene, you're getting flirtatious with him.
Seems to be getting worse, doesn't she, sir?
You will please not refer to your mistress as she. Thank you, Nancy.
Going to work on your tunes again tonight, sir? You're always working, aren't you?
Yes. What are you doing with your evening out?
Oh, I'm going to a musical. Up in a balloon, boys, up in a...
I've never been to an English musical.
Oh, you don't know what you've missed, sir. Up in a balloon, boys, up in a balloon. You like it a lot, sir.
Well, we must see about that. And whom are you going to the musical with?
Gentleman friend, sir.
Oh, now you know, Nancy, don't you? That gentleman friends are sometimes inclined to take liberties with young ladies.
Oh, no, sir. Not with me. I can take care of myself when I want to.
You know, Nancy, it strikes me that you're not at all the kind of girl that your mistress should have for a housemaid.
No, sir. She's not the only one in the house, is she?
Angela Lansbury, was
chic.
That, was that your bit of business, singing that vaudeville kind of song, Up in a Balloon?
No, nothing was my idea in that movie. That was all prearranged and thought up by George Cukor, yeah. And John Van Druten, who was the screenwriter of that.
Were there things that you were very naive and in the dark about in that film that you tried to cover up for so that people wouldn't know how green you were?
I can't honestly say, except by my on-set demeanor. I think my on-set demeanor was a very, very careful, covered, rather shy attitude about what I was doing. When I say that, I don't mean that I was aware of that, but I know from my own uncertainty about my personal... you see, I've always been a very private person. When it comes to the work, I'm on solid ground. When it comes to the Angela Lansbury, the young woman, I was on very uncertain ground. So I had to marry those two rather carefully, and that's why, as I say, I always felt that I had to, tread rather warily. From a personal point of view, just listen and hear and do what I was told and asked to do. I could discuss it, but in most instances, I was pretty quick to pick up directorial indications from somebody like George Cukor because he was extremely clear and funny and helpful. And what he said, I understood. So you could say I was fortunate in that I could understand what he wanted and then deliver it. This is what I do, and this is what I always maintained throughout my career, was that I had that ability to take direction and also to understand what was required of the character.
Do you remember any of the more helpful or interesting directions that Cukor gave you?
Well, simply that he felt that she was a naughty, rather dirty girl, and that was the way he saw her. He felt she was... And when I... gave him that, he thought it was terribly funny, and he encouraged me to be this snotty, cocky little person who was able to dominate Charles Boyer with inference. What I inferred was a great deal more than what I was saying, and this my ability to do that worked, thank goodness, because I understood exactly what Cukor was asking me to do. And, you know, and I said, well, you know, she's not the only one in the house, is she? You know, that
right.
Came, I mean, totally, I understood that, and that made me roar with laughter.
Well, you were still a minor when you were making Gaslight. What kind of special provisions were made for you on the set?
Oh, it was required that there was a social worker with me until my 18th birthday, which I celebrated on the set of Gaslight, actually. And I always remember it because Ingrid and Charles and George Cukor were so wonderfully kind. And Ingrid gave me lovely bottles of Strategy, which was a lovely smelly cologne, which I'd never had anything as lovely as that. And the powder, you know, sort of talcum powder and things, a set. I always remember that. It's interesting, the things you do remember. And we celebrated, and I was able to take a cigarette out of a packet in my purse and smoke it, which I hadn't been able to let on that I had been smoking from the time I was really about 14 years old. I say that without any sense of pride at all, and I stopped smoking 30 years ago. But nevertheless, as I don't know whether you remember, but I do smoke a rather long cigarettello in the movie, and that was part of the business in the movie of Gaslight. But they only let me puff it, and I wasn't allowed to inhale, as Mr. Clinton would say. So, but in fact, I had been smoking for a couple of years.
Gaslight is one of those movies with really nice black and white lighting. Do you remember getting lit for the film and what that process was like?
Very well. I do remember very well. Joseph Ruttenberg was the DP on that, and he was an extraordinarily careful, painstaking person when it came to lighting women. And I think some of the shots of Ingrid Bergman are some of the most beautiful, tremulous, lovely shots I've ever seen in black and white photography, except for what he did for Garbo and those. But certainly we all were the beneficiaries of his artistry.
You were nominated for an Oscar Best Supporting Actress for that first role.
Mm-hmm.
You lost to Ethel Barrymore. It must have been pretty heady to be nominated your first time out.
Oh, I should say so. I was absolutely knocked off my pins. Couldn't believe it.
My guest is Angela Lansbury. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Angela Lansbury is my guest, and she's one of this year's Kennedy Center honorees. In 1946, you made The Harvey Girls with Judy Garland. This was your first musical, but you weren't allowed to sing in it. You were dubbed. I mean, I love your singing voice. What? Why wouldn't they let you sing?
Because I really hadn't developed it at that time. I did not have the kind of rather tough voice that they was required to sing that role. So I'm not saying I couldn't have done it, but they chose to have me dubbed.
How did you react when they told you that you couldn't sing yourself and that you'd be dubbed?
Once again, I decided they know best. They're driving the wagon here, and they know. And I did not fight with them or say, you're wrong. I tried it. I did sing the songs for them. And when you think about who the creative musical team were on that movie, Roger Edens, Kay Thompson, Connie Salinger, I mean, they were all there, and they all heard me sing, and they decided my voice was too light. And I think they were right, actually. I have to agree with them when I see the movie.
Because you were playing a tough saloon girl, so...
Sure.
Yeah.
I had my work cut out for me just selling everybody on the idea that I could play a Western dance hall girl.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This English kid, you know, I was only 18.
Did you feel comfortable at MGM in Hollywood in the 40s, with all the kind of glamour and publicity surrounding the movies then?
It was a hard adjustment for me. I wanted to play the game, you know. I wanted to be like the rest of the girls. I was still enough of an adolescent in my heart, although I always say that I sort of missed my adolescence. But part of me wanted to be like the girls who were under contract. But I really wasn't. I just didn't fit in that mold. And I know now that it was a difficult period of trying to be what I really wasn't. the only, let's say, the comfort I took was, and even then I kind of leant on it, was the fact that I knew that I was an actress and that I could play different roles, because I was continuously being offered extraordinary stretches, shall we say, as an actress, to play parts which were way out of my range. However, I would do it, and I managed to just skin by the skin of my teeth, you know, playing roles that where I was much older than I actually was, playing Walter Pigeon's wife in If Winter Comes, you know. I don't know you even know that movie with
I haven't seen it.
No, well, it was one of those films of the 1940s with Deborah Carr. And I was playing older women. I was playing Frank Morgan's wife as the Queen of France in The Three Musketeers. I got to dress up and look kind of staggering and terrific with all this paraphernalia that was laid on me. But I was still way out of my age range. So I was never going to get to play the girl next door, and I was never going to be groomed to be a glamorous movie star. And I sort of realized that, so I had to make peace with myself on that score.
Well, how did you feel about playing the older women?
I hated it. I mean, I didn't enjoy it, and I fought it, and I tried hard. I would go to the studio heads and say, look, don't make me play this part. But they would sort of say, well, if you will play that part this week, we'll let you do such and so next week, kind of attitude. So I would end up doing it. And it all added to my training, really. It was like training on the job. And I think you never, nothing is ever goes to waste as an actress. You docket it all away and you remember and you use stuff later. So it didn't do any harm. And I was being paid, good heavens. You know, I was under contract and I was making $500 a week or $750 a week, which in those days was an enormous amount of money. It enabled me to help my family, and so I was a working actress.
It's funny because your situation was the opposite of Judy Garland. For years, she tried to get out of playing the juvenile and grow up in a movie.
Yes, well, there you go. You see, we all have different problems as youngsters.
Angela Lansbury, she'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Do you hear that whistle down the line? I figure that it's engine number 49. She's the only one that'll sound that way on the edge of Santa Topeka and the Santa Fe. See the old smoke rising round the bend. I reckon that she knows she's gonna meet a friend. Folks around these parts get time on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble. Booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Eddie Bauer, supporting radio expeditions and offering outdoor-inspired clothing, accessories, and home furnishings. In stores, catalogs, and at eddiebauer.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Singing, we continue our conversation with actress Angela Lansbury. She starred in the musicals Mame, Gypsy, and Sweeney Todd.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Angela Lansbury. This weekend, Lansbury will receive a Kennedy Center honor, along with Chuck Berry, Mikhail Baryshnikov, Placido Domingo, and Clint Eastwood. Lansbury's movies include Gaslight, The Picture of Dorian Gray, The Manchurian Candidate, and Blue Hawaii. Her musicals include Mame, Gypsy, and Sweeney Todd. And on TV, she's best known for the series Murder, She Wrote. Your first marriage was to Richard Cromwell, who you later found out was actually gay, and that revelation, I think, is what ended the marriage. You must have been shocked when you found out.
I wouldn't say, yes, I was, but it's a very curious thing. I had known so many gay people in Hollywood. It just had never really sunk in. I was in love with love, it was a shock, but it wasn't a shock because I was so in love with Richard Cromwell when I married him that I was just, I'd never had any kind of experience. I had nothing to draw on. I had no experience sexually, and I didn't know. So when it turned out that he was, I never blamed him for it in any way, and I realized that I had just made an excruciating error, an emotional error. But I don't regret it because I learned so much during the short time that we were together, which was probably less than a year. But I give him credit for introducing me to so much that in my life I wouldn't have known about had it not been for him. It was a good experience.
I want to ask you about that in a moment, but I'm wondering, did he know he was gay? And do you think he married you to prove something to himself or to have a cover for the rest of the world?
Oh, no, none of those things. No, he knew he was gay, of course. He'd had many gay relationships, I discovered as years went by. He'd never had an ongoing one. And I think he was a romantic who loved the idea of marrying a young woman who he absolutely adored from what he'd seen on the screen.
Right.
And that he really fell in love with the girl he'd seen on the screen.
So how did you find out that he was gay?
Oh, not until after I had he had left, and I suddenly discovered that was the reason through his psychiatrist, actually.
So you say you learned a lot from him. What are some of the things you learned?
Well, he had an extraordinary group of friends, wonderful people in the business who I never would have met. He was a great friend of Joan Crawford's and Bill Holden and Zachary Scott and all kinds of actors and actresses of that era. And he also had an incredible library of music. Of old 78 records in those days. This was before the LPs and even the 45s came out. And he had people like Merman on record from the year Dot, So I got to listen to all kinds of performers who, Russ Columbo, people, all sorts of vocalists and, as I say, musicians. And his whole life had been listening to these records, and he had an enormous collection. And he had a great, great recording machine that used to slam down. You could put 12 records on it, and I'm sure many of our listeners will remember those. But, we would listen to music all the time. He also had a tremendous classical repertoire of music in his collection. And I listened to that. I learned to listen to Ravel. I listened to all kinds of composers that I had never had any access to before. And Richard Strauss and people, So he educated me in many, many respects as far as music and also about show business. Broadway. That's where I listened to some of the great vocalists.
You talked about how in the Harvey Girls your voice was considered to be too high and too small for that kind of role.
Did you learn a different style of singing from being exposed to all the singers in his collection?
Absolutely. Oh, sure. I picked up a tremendous amount at MGM working with Kay Thompson and Judy and Andy Williams. All those Andy was a backup singer in those days. So I mean, most performers are like sponges, and we all pick up from one another. And you learn how to do certain things vocally and also interpretively, how to interpret something in a certain way. You might get it from Nina Simone, or you might get it from Judy, or you might get it from Merman. You never know. But you don't actively and consciously use it, but it's in there. So it suddenly manifests itself in what you're doing. So this is what I mean about my education at that time was so varied and so exciting from the point of view of what I was learning that I've used and called on it ever since.
Can you talk about any specific aspect of singing that you learned during that period?
Learned about lyrics, learned about clarity, learned that in my instance, because I'm an actress, I am going to sing the scene. I'm going to sing the scene. I'm not going to just spout the lyric. I'm going to sing the scene. And that's what I bring to singing, is because I'm not really a singer. I have a serviceable voice. But how I use it, it's the emotion under the note that sells the song. From my point of view, in other words, what I do is I use the emotional kick that I know is inherent in that moment, in that scene that I'm singing, and that's what sells the song.
Well, I feel a song cue coming on. I think maybe this is a good time to talk about Broadway. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the British production of Gypsy, in which you played Gypsy Rose Lee's mother. The role originated on Broadway by Ethel Merman. Mm-hmm. And you were asked to do this in England by Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book and directed the British production. Mm-hmm. You knew Merman's work. I assume you probably saw her on Broadway in Gypsy. How did you feel about taking on a role that she had done?
I was completely nonplussed. I said no. In 1972, when Barry Brown and Arthur and Fritz Holt, Barry's partner, asked me to do Gypsy in London, I said, you've got to be kidding. I said, I could no more approach that role, having treasured the recording of Ethel Merman singing Rose. I know what's required here, and I know what a absolutely tremendous, overpowering role it is, and I don't think I'm up for it. I mean, and then as the year went by, Arthur really got at me, and he said, Angie, he said, Rose, I wrote Rose as a great character. It's an enormous acting role. We want you to, we know you can sing it as far as your own rendition of the songs. We want your dramatic input. We want the role to be played by an actress, and we would really encourage you to do this. So I said yes. But it took me a year.
Well, I should mention that in Craig Zaden's book about Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence really praises your interpretation of this role. And he says, with no disrespect to Merman, it's the first time that the number Rose's Turn was done the way it should be. It's hair-raising, and it's because Angie's an actress. I know of no one else in the musical theater who can sing as well as she does and be the actress that she is. So I'd like to play part of Rose's Turn, and this is, you know, toward the end of Gypsy. You've been the stage mother, you know, throughout your life, and Gypsy Rose Lee has become your daughter has become a famous stripper, but you're wondering, when's it your turn? When's it your turn to be on stage and to be before the lights? So you're on stage in front of an empty theater and singing your number. And anything else you want to say about it before we hear it?
No, except to say that it's one of the most rewarding pieces of musical theater to perform there is, and one of the hardest.
Well, if this isn't an example of singing the scene, as the way you put it, I don't know what it is. What is? Here's Angela Lansbury.
Why did I do it? Why did it get me? Scrapbooks full of me in the background. Give them love and what does it get you? Why does it get you? One quick look as each of them leaves you. All your life and why does it get you? Thanks a lot and out for the garbage. They take bows and you're batting zero. I had a dream. I dreamed it for you, June. It wasn't for me, Hurley. And if it wasn't for me, then where would you be, Miss Gypsy Rose Lee? Well, someone tell me, when is it my turn? Don't I get a dream for myself? Starting now, it's gonna be my turn. Gangway world, get off of my runway. Starting now, I bat a thousand. This time, boys, I'm taking the vows and everything's coming up.
Angela Lansbury, doing that number must have been exhausting. I mean, it seems like it would be so emotionally depleting. Forget everything that it does with your throat, but just the emotion of it. What was it like right after that number on stage?
People ask me that often, and I must say when people would come backstage after the performance, they would be in tears. I would be drinking a glass of water and breathing a big sigh of relief. I never allow the emotion of a scene, if possible, to get to me. This is not true always, but in that case, I was doing it 8 performances a week, you have to understand, and I could not allow it to intrude into my own emotional state. So I could do it. It's a technique. It is a technique, and that's acting. And people don't really always believe this, and some people are absolutely drained and washed out, and they sit in their dressing rooms for hours after having done Rose's Turn, I'm sure, and say, I don't know whether I can leave the theater. But I was not one of those people. To me, when it's over, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Angela Lansbury, and she's one of this year's Kennedy Center honorees. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is okay. Fresh Air. My guest is Angela Lansbury. I want to ask you about a different kind of musical. In the Elvis Presley musical Blue Hawaii, you played Elvis's mom.
Yes.
What did you think about the opportunity to...
It's one of my great claims to fame. Yes. I've got to tell you that.
Were you interested in Elvis at all?
Of course I was interested in Elvis. Who wouldn't be? I mean, he was such a riveting, dazzling person, but in those days, of course, he just come out of the army, and he was a sweet, sexy young Southern guy, you know, and I was just as interested in it as everybody, and how he was, and he always treated me very courteously, and as I say, with great pause, and I liked him. He was terrific.
What was it like being like the adult, the mother, in what was clearly like a movie for teenagers?
Well, you see, I got to play a comedy part. She was really a bit of a character. And I was exercising my Southern accent for the first time. And therefore, I was playing a character. I was playing this nutty, crazy lady who was his mom. And I loved doing it. And it was most enjoyable. And we worked well together, and it worked like gangbusters.
Were there things that were done for Elvis's image in the movie that you found interesting or amusing?
I didn't notice that. I wasn't aware of it particularly. Looking back, I just remember him being surrounded with the cousins, and he was always breaking bricks, or he was doing karate at that time. And so they were always worried that he was going to break his hand just before he was going to shoot. but he was this wonderfully built, vital young fella, and he really just loved life and was everything everybody expected him to be.
Let's hear a scene from the movie.
Now we must decide on the orchestra for the party.
Oh, well, if you'll excuse me, I think I'll freshen up a little before dinner.
Oh.
Aloha.
Yeah, orchestra? Say, Momsy, how about my friends?
You mean those native boys?
They got the swingingest group in the islands.
Oh, they are not musicians, Chadwick. They're just beach boys.
Mom, they've turned professional. They do a lot of work around town.
Now, how'd you know that?
Why, he corresponded with them while he was in Europe.
Now, Chadwick, we might as well have an understanding right off. You've come home to stay, and your life's going to be different. You're going to associate yourself with the finer elements on this island, and you're going to have a responsible position with a great Southern Hawaiian fruit company, and you're going to marry a girl of your own class and be a gentleman like your daddy.
Mom, do we have to discuss this now?
Yes, I don't want you wasting your precious time on those beach boys or that native girl.
Sara Lee, the boy just came home.
Well, I think he should know exactly what we expect of him. Well,
I know what you expect of me. I thought maybe after a hitch in the army, I could come back here and do what you want me to. But now I know I can't.
Well, how do you know? You just got back.
I've been back for 5 days, Mom.
5 days?
Yes, and for 5 days, I've been at the beach living in my shack and dreading the time I would have to come back here and tell you. I'm not going to go to work for the Great Southern Hawaiian Fruit Company.
Sara Lee.
Yes, Daddy?
Let's talk about it tomorrow, son.
Home 5 days? And it didn't even come to his mother.
Mom, it's time I started.
Well, Angela Lansbury, the year after you made Blue Hawaii, you made the Manchurian Candidate. You made the Manchurian Candidate in 1962, and in this movie, a terrific movie, you're a manipulative, domineering mother and wife who's trying to promote the political career of your husband. And it turns out you're actually part of a conspiracy to assassinate the political opponent and take over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And in this scene, you're telling your son, who has been brainwashed, that he has to be the assassin.
You are to shoot the presidential nominee through the head. And Johnny will rise gallantly to his feet and lift Ben Arthur's body in his arms, and stand in front of the microphones and begin to speak. The speech is short, but it's the most rousing speech I've ever read. It's been worked on here and in Russia, on and off, for over 8 years. I shall force someone to take the body away from him. Then Johnny will really hit those microphones and those cameras with blood all over him, fighting off anyone who tries to help him, defending America even if it means his own death, rallying a nation of television viewers into hysteria to sweep us up into the White House with powers that will make martial law seem like anarchy. Now, this is very important. I want the nominee to be dead about 2 minutes after he begins his acceptance speech, depending on his reading time under pressure. You are to hit him right at the point that he finishes the phrase. Nor would I ask of any fellow American, in defense of his freedom, that which I would not gladly give myself. My life before my liberty. Is that absolutely clear?
Wow. And at the end
of
that
scene, speech.
Yes. And at the end of that scene, before you send your son off to kill the candidate, you kiss him on each cheek, then kiss him fully on the mouth.
Oh, yes.
How'd you feel about that scene?
Oh, I thought it was very telling. Very telling.
And how'd you feel about playing such a really evil role?
They are the best. Any actress will tell you that evil roles to play are the best. You can go to town, you know. And in that instance, I think that woman had so many layers and so many personas, in a sense. She was riveting and so interesting to play. I relish having had that opportunity to play that role, because I don't think there are many written like that. I consider that she was the Lear among, movie women.
My guest is Angela Lansbury. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Angela Lansbury. This weekend, she'll receive a Kennedy Center honor. We've talked about your long and really wonderful career on stage and screen. I think some of our listeners will know you best from television for your work on Murder, She Wrote as Jessica Fletcher, who has solved God knows how many murders over the years that you did that show. Did you ever count how many murders you solved?
264.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What was it like for you after playing so many different roles over the years to settle into one role for several years?
When I first started Murder, She Wrote, I thought it would last maybe 2-3 years, you know, or maybe a year if we were lucky. But when it extended and I realized the deep inroads it had made into family life in America, I couldn't stop. So I was sort of trapped, happily trapped, for 12 years with it. And I'm still playing Jessica from time to time and loving it. I wouldn't want to let go of that lady.
What did you like about her?
She was the sort of woman I like, and therefore I enjoyed playing her, and being Jessica was second nature to me, because she embodied all of the qualities that I like about women. She was valiant and liberal and athletic and exciting and sexy and all kinds of good stuff that women are of a certain age and are not given credit for. So to be able to play that gave me tremendous sort of pleasure, and I'm so glad I've done it.
You know, the press release for the Kennedy Center honor describes you as a beloved actress, which I think is pretty accurate, but do you feel beloved?
From playing Jessica Fletcher, yes, I do. I do feel a sense of tremendous warmth from the American public who have known and loved that program. I really do. I know they. I don't know whether they're mixing me up with a character, and it really doesn't matter. The main thing is I feel their gratitude so often for all the nights.
Well, I guess a role like in The Manchurian Candidate doesn't earn you the word beloved, actually.
No, it certainly does.
Fantastic, maybe, but not beloved.
No, it takes a show like Murder, She Wrote, I think, to bring that enormous audience to one and to make them aware of who you are and what you've done, you know?
So what do you have coming up now?
Well, actually, I've got a lovely new Murder, She Wrote 2-hour movie called The Last Free Man, which I'm very, very thrilled about, and I'll be making another one of those. I had hoped to return to Broadway in a musical called The Visit. However, I was unable to make that decision. My husband was not well enough for me to feel I could put my energy and attention to it, so I'm not going to do it. However, I'll hope to be doing movies again in the future and maybe sometime to return to the theater. I hope so. I know Peter would like that. So we're just sort of living a day at a time and hoping things will improve.
Well, I thank you so very much for talking with us, and congratulations again on the Kennedy Center honor.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you. And as I say, I listen to your program all the time.
Angela Lansbury will receive the Kennedy Center honor this weekend. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Let's bring back Angela Lansbury to sing a song from Sweeney Todd, in which she played the baker who makes the worst pies in London. This is the song in which she and Sweeney decide to chop up his murder victims and bake them into pies.
Well, you know me, bright ideas just pop into my head and I keep thinking. Seems a downright shame.
Shame?
Seems an awful waste. Such a nice plump frame, what's his name as? Ad, has, nor he can't be traced. Business needs a lift, debts to be erased. Think of it as thrift, as a gift, if you get my drift. No? Seems an awful waste. I mean, with the price of meat, what it is, when you get it, if you get it.
Huh.
Good you got it. Take, for instance, Mrs. Mooney and a pie shop. Business never better, using only pussycats and toast. And a pussy's good for maybe 6 or 7 at the most. And I'm sure they can't compare as far as taste.
Mrs. Lovett, what a charming notion.
Well,
and a handy practical and
yet
appropriate
waste.
As always. Mrs. Lovett, how I've lived without you all these years, I never know.
Think
how
about it, lot of other gentlemen will soon be coming for a shame. Won't they think of
choice,
all their
pies? Oh, what's the sound of the world out there?
What, Mr. Todd, what, Mr. Todd, what is that sound?
Those crunching noises pervading the air.
Yes, Mr. Todd, yes, Mr. Todd, yes, all around.
It's man devouring man, my dear. And who are we to gain our head in here? Ah, these are desperate times, Mrs. Lovett. And desperate measures must be taken.
Here we are now, hot out of the oven.
What is that?
It's priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh. So it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
No, you see, the trouble with poet is how do you know it's deceased?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Alexander Kasar, author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the U.S., and is it time to end the Chad era? We talk about new voting technologies with Kim Alexander, founder of the California Voter Foundation. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.